Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. This one with Brian Silva, we did a little differently. Started having a conversation and it just worked. So don't have that normal intro that we had at most of our podcasts. Thanks for listening. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to us, rate us in the iTunes App Store. It really helps us out. More eyeballs on the podcast. And if you haven't, please subscribe to the Fried Egg newsletter. It's sent every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. It's the easiest way to stay up to date with golf and everything that's going on. So thanks again. And without further ado, here is Brian Silva.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
I've been out at the Western Am this week, which is at Skokie Country Club.
Yes.
I mean, unbelievable set of greens. And, you know, they have this one that has this massive false front. They have a couple with them. But, you know, this guy is complaining. I was with my buddy in a practice round, and this guy's complaining. He's like, I don't understand why this is all green here. It's not like they can put a pin there. And I'm like, well, that's why your ball will roll 20 yards down the hill. You know, it makes the hole green, you know?
It's hard for people to appreciate that the green, under the best circumstances, is part of the hazard on a hole.
Mm-hmm.
And it's better that you hear things like that than I do, because I don't hide my visual reaction when some knucklehead says something like that.
Yeah.
You know, all they're trying to do is make every golf course in America like every other golf course in America and kind of homogenize, vanilla-ize it down to the least interesting, most standard, least unexciting thing. It's unbelievable. It's such an incredible double standard. You know, a course has a really unique, beautiful clubhouse. Those people who want to just dummy down their golf course and make it look like every other golf course would never say, you know, our clubhouse, it's really too unique.
Yeah.
We really need to tear it down and, like, put up a metal Butler building. Oh, and then they'll say, a Butler building that's easier to maintain, because everything that gets done, I say to people, sadly, when we do a project, there's maybe 10 items of interest that everyone's talking about keeping in mind throughout the entire project. And, you know, bullet points or whatever you want to call them. One is the most important. It's the one that gets talked about the most. And 10 is the least important, the one that gets talked about at the least. I swear, more often than not, characteristics of golf course design find themselves largely lodged in number 10.
Mm-hmm.
It's, how do we get the cart paths around? And you know, I hit a perfect shot to this green. But because of this false front that shouldn't even be green, I ended up 20 yards back in the fairway. That's not fair. So it's fascinating. And all it proves, Andy, and don't take this personally, is guys like you and me haven't done a good enough job educating.
Yeah, No, I agree.
You know what I mean? And unfortunately, we're swimming against the tide, because more often than not, when a new course gets, well, they don't get built anymore, but when work gets done, it really, you would think their goal was to take the character out of the course, to take the unique features out of the course. It's unfortunate. Now, don't get me wrong. I think there's the swell work going on out there, but there still is this inertia to make every golf course look like it was built in the 1960s, and that's unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, I watched this kid Cameron Champ yesterday play, and he's like one of the longest guys on, you know, he'd be the longest guy on tour. He's a college kid. He kills it. And he played this 400-yard hole. The pin was way up front on the right side, and he hit driver up to like 30 yards, and he was absolutely dead because, he, you know, the way the green was, and this is a green that would never be built by today.
Right, right.
And the way the green was, he had a knob in front of this front pin and a knob behind it, and he had nothing. He couldn't do anything. And it's like, okay, like that was a really bad play. Like you need to have a full shot going into that green. And,
right, right. And like, yes.
And people are, you know, how do you defend distance? How do you, but like great green complexes defend well because then you have to play angles and you have to have a strategy going into the hole rather than just, you know, pull out driver and bludgeon the course. And that's what I think.
Those are outlandish thoughts, Andy, that you'd actually think on the tee where you want to be to best access the green. You're going in the wrong direction, big guy. You know, it's all power golf. it's very sad.
I sense a hint of sarcasm.
I mean, I see why a lot of people are like that. And because if you put a percentage on the number of courses in the United States that don't require that thought, that don't have the angles, that don't have the strategy, that don't have multiple routes, I'm afraid that percentage would be above 90%. And so they're not used, they've never seen it before. And when they see it, they find it odd because they don't see it. You know, I can't do a project without trying to force a stupid punch bowl green in on it. And people say, well, what the fuck is that? I said, well, it's a punch bowl green. Have you ever been to Scotland? Every course kind of has one. And there were these two knuckleheads named McDonald and Rayner who used to do them. And these are the names of the courses. You know, they've done them on, oh, I've heard of those courses. So it's an interesting craft.
It's how'd you get into golf course architecture?
My dad was in light construction. Well, he started out working for a big company, J.F. White, that built part of Logan Airport. He ran a bulldozer. He did the Mass Pike extension into Boston. But then in the early 60s, and Andy, no answers are short with me, so just tell me to shut up.
You've heard enough. The beauty of this format is you can just talk, and it's great. It's just a conversation. So,
but my dad had a little bit of a reputation as a bulldozer operator, and I grew up in Framingham, Massachusetts. And oddly enough, there was a guy in Framingham, Massachusetts, who was in a construction company that built golf courses and playing fields. So he needed a guy to shape greens and tees and bunkers in the early 60s, and he said to my dad, hey, why don't you come try working with us for a week, and we can see how it goes. And after a week, Bob Drake said to my father, you are the only guy who's going to do stuff for me. By that time, my dad and another guy from Framingham had started a small construction company, just two guys. They had a couple bulldozers, a couple backhoes, and for the spring, summer, and fall for the next 18 or 20 years, that's what my dad did. He did shaping for this guy named Bob Drake, some new courses, but mostly renovation to existing courses, and that's what I wanted to do. But, you know, my dad, he worked on the machine 6 days a week, and then on Sunday he was his own mechanic. He'd do repairs and maintenance. And he didn't want me doing that. So ever since I found out I wouldn't make it in the National Hockey League, which I found out when I was 13 and I went to a summer hockey school with kids all from all over Canada and the United States, and it took me about 10 minutes to realize I'd never make it in the NHL, I decided I wanted to be a golf course architect. And my dad worked on a lot of Jeffrey Cornish projects, who Jeff did a lot of work in New England. And when I was in high school, I met Mr. Cornish and said, "What should a kid do who wants to be a golf course architect?" And Jeff said, "Well, you should go to turf school for 2 years, and then you should get your bachelor's in landscape architecture, and you should work on golf courses during the summer." And that was in those heady days when I actually listened to what people told me. So that's what I did. And when I was at I went to graduate school in plant and soil sciences. And when I was there, I taught. A professor left right at the last minute before fall semester started. So I taught a couple courses each semester in turf. I liked that a lot. I went down to Lake City Community College, where they used to have a 2-year program that trained superintendents. I taught there for 3 years, and I wanted to get back to New England. I worked for the USGA Green Section, you know, the agronomist staff, mm-hmm. visiting golf courses. And then one day, Mr. Cornish and I just happened to be visiting the same golf course on the same day. We were walking it, and all the committee people were in carts. And when they went to get the carts and we were walking down a hole, Jeff turned to me and said, "You know, I think it's time you got involved in golf course design. Why don't you come work with me, and then I'll retire after a few years, and you can just run with the ball, and, you know, like some wet behind the ears kind of guy." And I said, "Well, Jeff, let me think about it for a week." I mean, the minute he said it, I knew what was happening. So a week later, I called
you. You played it cool, though, and you were like, "Oh, let me think about my options."
No, the only thing that was obvious is I immediately wet my pants. But, you know, I called him back and said, "I want to do that." And he said, "Okay, this is how we're going to do it. I want you to work for the United States Golf Association for 5 more years. You've only worked there for 2 years. And I just said, "Jeff, I cannot know that this is going to happen." Sort of my dream. I said, "You're a wicked, awesome, nice gentleman." I said, let me just finish this season. And next winter, I'll come on with you." And so in February of 83, I went on with Jeff. And so that's kind of the way I got my start. You know, if you're not Jack Nicklaus or someone like that, it's still very much like the European system of an apprentice occupation, Andy, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
The Brian Silvers of the world don't just put a shingle out and say, "Hi, I'm a golf course architect," and then get jobs. And it's appropriate that they should learn and train under somebody who's really well experienced. So I was lucky. You know, when things were moving and grooving in the 80s and the 90s and the early 2000s, I would say that Jeff and I got at least 100 resumes a year from kids in turf school, from kids from landscape architecture school, from 50-year-old guys who wanted to get out of the financial business, who wanted to become golf architects and wanted to know how to do that. And out of all those people, not many get a chance. And I was just unbelievably fortunate to get a chance, because in all honesty, I still get things where they send me, you know, full-size plans of these imaginary golf courses, and they do grading plans, and I just say to myself, "Wow, my stuff isn't half as good as this." And, you know, they're trying to get in, so I was just real lucky.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times it's opportunity and, you know, hard work intersect, and you got kind of the good start there. I mean, it's interesting. I look at the landscape of the architecture world, and especially with, you know, the economic slowdown, now you have this marketplace where there aren't enough jobs for how many talented, like, associates that work for guys like Core and Crenshaw and Doak. And, you know, if you look back to the 80s and 90s, those guys would be, you know, have their own architecture firms now. Do you think
that? We had a couple young guys who work for us in the office, and one of them named Brian Johnson. His father was a golf pro, so Brian's been doodling golf holes since he was about six. He had to get out of it because there was no work. He's got a management company now in Houston, Texas, and he manages a golf course for a guy. I'm going to tell you something. If he ever got a chance, he would blow everyone in the industry away. He does my drafting now, so I still get his... He's unbelievably talented and imaginative. I still get the benefit of his imagination, but it's really sad that a kid like Brian, who wants it as much as anyone I've ever known, and who is more talented than anyone I've ever known, the multiple routes he thinks about it, oh, geez, and the strategy and the angles is just incredible. It's too bad.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And it's no fault. It's through no fault of theirs. You know, this is the truth. I got to do some work, not insignificantly, just by lucky timing.
Yeah.
That, you know, nobody likes to say stuff like that, but that's the truth. You know, being born when I was and getting into the work when I was. There were ups and downs, you know, but nothing like it is now in terms of new courses. I really lived through a 25-year boom, and that's why, you know, when I see guys now and they bemoan how quiet it is, I don't want to say the wrong thing, but there are times when I'll say, well, don't you think when we were all building 300 brand-new courses a year, that was maybe as ridiculous on one side of the equation as just building five new courses a year. But you know what happens, Andy? You know, when you're in the heat of the battle and that many courses are getting built and it goes on for a couple decades or more, it's easy to think, well, this is the way it is.
Yep.
And, you know, in one way, it was the way it is. In another way, it definitely was not the way it is. And so if you live through that and you're complaining now, I just don't know that you're taking a very realistic viewpoint. But like Brian Johnson, I feel bad for these talented guys and gals who just can't get their chance. It further proves to me how fortunate a knucklehead like myself, how fortunate I was.
I don't know. It's like that old, I think it was the player saying, you know, the more you work, the luckier you get. And it sounds like you put in a lot of hard work, so.
Oh, no. I did, but you know what, Andy, and I did. I worked. I believe I worked as hard as anyone. When I used to go to the Architect Society meetings and I'd talk, you know, after dinner with guys, what are you doing? And there's this, they would just, the volume of work would stun them a little bit. But you still can't, and my wife says the same thing. Oh, honey, you worked really hard. You left on Monday and you didn't come back till Saturday. All while Amanda was growing up, you worked hard. And I said, yeah, but you cannot get away from the fact that I had the chance.
Mm-hmm.
Most, you know, it's a small profession. A lot of people never had a chance. So I realize how fortunate I was.
So,
I think when it's busy, you can sometimes forget that. You can forget how, hey, I got it going on. But again, I think seeing Brian Johnson, he's a great kid, really good player. And, I had him up and we played golf for a few days in May, and I got up one morning and on my desk was a couple of 8.5 by 11 sheets of papers of golf holes he'd designed over the night while he couldn't sleep. And when I got up, I saw him and he was already up. And he says, "Bri, I really wanna get back in this." And I said, "I know you do, Bri, but I said, you know, you have a really good job right now. It's probably paying you more than you could do if you could just scratch out a job in somebody's office." And I know he wants me to get busy enough to need full-time help, and I'm not sure that will ever happen again.
Yeah.
The being home during the recession, being home more than two nights a week was a real eye-opening experience for me. I enjoyed it more than I could have ever imagined.
Mm-hmm. So you've done a lot of restorations too, and I'd love to talk a little bit about kind of the golden age architects that you've encountered and kind of learned from, and who you consider your biggest influences and why.
Well, I got to go modern first, Andy.
Mm-hmm.
Because early on in my life, when I was teaching at Lake City, and see, during the summer, when there were no classes, my job was to drive around the Southeast and visit courses where my students were working on their summer on-the-job training thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to, you know, Harbortown and, well, and even Seminole, which Pete didn't design, but he was a member of.
Mm-hmm.
I started to think that his courses were a little bit different than other people's courses. And it wasn't just, it was decidedly not the railroad ties or pot bunkers or strip bunkers. There was something going on there, and that kind of planted a little thing in my mind. I wish I had been bright enough to fully understand it. And then when I became a USJ agronomist up in the Northeast, I saw lots of golf courses, but I started to really like these McDonald and Rainer golf courses.
Mm-hmm.
There was something going on there. I wasn't quite sure what it was, but I knew they were different, and they were fun to play, but they were still challenging. But I still was so stupid, I couldn't really boil it down to its fundamentals. And I'm going to tell you a story I never tell in public. But we used to close the office the first week in December back when we had an office, and we'd go out to La Quinta, California. I had friends who worked for Landmark, and we would play like Ryder Cup matches against them for a week. There'd be four of us against four of them, and we would play La Quinta Mountain, La Quinta Citrus. We'd play PGA West. We'd play the old Dynasure. We'd play the new Dynasure. So it was a Pete Dye extravaganza.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I felt there was something about his courses, and this is the truth, and I'm a little embarrassed about this. One night after dinner, I walked over to La Quinta Hotel, and this was in December, about 2 weeks after they'd had the Skins game at PGA West.
Yeah.
And I sat next to the fireplace, and in a little wicker basket next to the fireplace, there were the program books that they sold during the Skins game.
Yeah.
And are you taping me, Andy?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, all right. Then I won't use great expletives. in this wicker basket was a program, and I opened it up, and the center fold, you know, only a guy interested in design can go nuts about a centerfold,
mm-hmm.
which is an aerial photograph of PGA West. You know, and when you look down on it from the sky, immediately I said, oh, holy crap, it's all about angles.
Mm-hmm.
I could see the angles that Pete had put in, how a green might point down, point at the hook side of the fairway, and how there was one of his bite-off strip bunkers that went down the right side, and the more you bit off, the more you aligned with the green. And I said, honest to God, I said, oh, you stupid SOB, you were on the edge of this, but it didn't the different little points didn't all go together to make you realize it. And that day, what I thought about golf course design completely changed. So it was really Pete's angles hit me. I didn't fully form it in my mind or verbalize it. And then Rainer McDonald, I saw more of that. And then when I saw this picture, it completely changed the way I thought. I knew my corridors for play had to be much wider. I knew we had to cut down trees to give people the width that allows alternate routes. Mm-hmm. It was really, it was a interesting for me, awakening. If you said to me, Brian, what would you do different in your life? I would say to you, well, I would have gone to see all the golf courses I did when I was working at the college, when I was growing up, going to my dad's jobs, when I was a USGA green section agronomist, but I would have gone and visited even more, and I would have stopped looking at the turf.
Mm-hmm.
I would have looked at what I call the skeleton, the tops of the tees, the top of the fairway, and the top of the green, and I would look at what angles are presented by that, because I think that that is 99.9% of what allows a golf course to be strategic, but also what allows a golf course to be played by the average and less than average player, but what allows a golf course to still be mentally stimulating for an excellent player. To me, it's angles and almost nothing else. And so this age of the internet, Google Earth is my favorite site, because when I get called, hey, this is so-and-so from such-and-such country club, I'm on Google Earth doing my homework before I get out there. And the funny thing is, you know, they'll say to me when I'm walking a course, so what do you think of the conditions? And I say, look, I'll tell you what I think of the conditions, because I kind of, you know, I have a turf degree. I have a master's training in plant and soil sciences. I was a USGA agronomist, but I said, I'm really not here to tell you about your turf. I'm interested, and if you'll forgive me, I think you should be interested in the design character of your golf course. Does it present angles? Does it present alternate routes of play? And so on and so forth. So those are my influences in a long answer, Andy.
So I'm curious. I'm all about angles and strategy, and I don't think it's really possible to have those without width. Do you agree with that?
No, I couldn't agree more. And being that I'm an old codger, I'm going to tell you secrets I don't normally tell. I used to teach a two-day seminar, first with Bob Lohman and then Jan Beljan for the Golf Course Superintendents Association, mm-hmm. and it was on golf course renovation, restoration, and construction. And one day during the seminar, a kid said to me, how wide do you clear your corridors when you're building a new course through the woods? And I was honest. I said, between 180 and 200 feet. And at lunch, Jan said to me, did you misunderstand that question? And I said, no. And she said, well, Brian, how do you do all the things you want to do on a golf hole in such a narrow corridor? This was before the light bulb went on with the aerial photograph of PGA West.
Mm-hmm.
Of all places, you know what I mean? You know, most people would think of PGA West and some of the pot bunkers and railroad ties and think it's not a sound course. But you see, that's the trouble today. They're looking at the superficial aspects of a golf course. They're not looking at the skeleton. Don't tell me about the skin, which is the turf, and don't tell me that much about the muscles and tendons, which are some of the railroad ties. What angles does it present? So Jan said that, and that kind of had an effect on me. And then there used to be trade magazine. Geez, I can't remember the name of it now that we're talking about it, but a law had been passed in Hawaii that said you could only clear corridors for golf holes like, I can't remember the number, 220 or whatever feet wide. And there was a comment from Nicholas that says, well, I don't see how we can build golf courses anymore. And his, gosh, I credit Jack with something that's very out of character. But Jan, because I really admire Jan, she was really a good friend of mine. And then I saw this aerial photograph and I said, I can't do what I want to do. It's like the tire commercial, wider is better. I can't do. And that's what people used to say with the courses of mine from a little bit later time in my career. A guy would play at friends of mine, they'd say, gee, you could fit three of your original golf holes in this golf hole. And I said, oh, I wasn't doing it right. Mm-hmm. It's got to be wider to allow the strategy and the different angles. And you know, I used to do lateral fairway bunkers like everybody in the 60s and,
yeah,
and a lot of people still today. Now I turn most of my fairway bunkers perpendicular shot so they bite into the fairway. Now, I like the fairway to swing out to the side, the opposite side, so it's still the same width, pretty much going all the way down. But, you know, it's like, I remember I saw Shinnecock when I worked for the USGA, and there was something going on there. I wasn't sure what it was. And when I read articles about Shinnecock, it was, well, Shinnecock's a great course because the fescue's blowing in the breeze and blah, blah,
yeah,
blah. That isn't it. It was because of its sinewy fairways that move to the right and then back to the left. It's set up on the same golf hole. It's set up fade drive zones. It's set up straight drive zones. It's set up hook drive zones. And when you, it's the same as the S turns that Pete puts into his fairways. So those things all, other people are able to coalesce these inputs quicker than I did.
Mm-hmm.
But once I did, I knew it was wider and that I really wanted to try to get some of those turns into the fairways because they so impacted strategy.
Well, I also imagine starting your career during that time, it was common practice for penal and tight, you know, hard golf was great golf. And people wanted to go out and struggle on the golf course, and that's what, you know, the developers wanted were hard golf courses as opposed to fun, playable, and courses that really infuse thought.
Yeah, you're kind, Andy, honest God, to suggest that. I just think there's a million reasons for someone to say why they weren't designing more strategic and thought-provoking golf courses. And I think the only good one is they hadn't evolved to that point in their thinking, or they just didn't think that way. I think that, you know, there was thought, but Pete was building hard golf courses with tremendously sinewy fairways that were very strategic, that I could go to and play the 6,300-yard marker and play to my handicap while the pros from the back markers were having trouble. So if you'll forgive me for saying, I am a piece of evidence number one that it's a little bit of a helpful excuse. You know, I think that people could have sold their developer on, look, we're going to make a great golf course here. Here's the eighth hole from Shinnecock that everyone raves about. Here's the 16th hole at Shinnecock that everyone raves about. And I've taken out the hay down the sides, so you're not distracted by that. The reason this is a great hole, well, the reasons this is a great hole is the green points in a particular direction. The fairway has lots of movement. If you want to set up a shot, a drive, so your approach shot works with the angle of the green, you either need to drop it short of that hook bunker, put it as close to the right of the hook bunker as you can, or hit a draw around that hook bunker, and that sets up the angle, and that's what makes it a great golf course, and That's what I want to do on your golf course. So you need to give me a little more width in the corridors between the houses going down both sides. Yeah. and we could achieve that kind of thing. So I think even today, you know, there are visible people out there who are putting these characteristics into their golf courses, but I think they could have put them in even in courses in the 80s and 90s. They could have convinced their owners that this can still be an interesting, difficult, because, I mean, look at PGA West. It's got sinewy fairways and angles 7 days a week. The pros played it the first year it was open as a Bob Hope, as a course during the Bob Hope tournament, and then they wrote they all put a petition. They never wanted to play it again, and they've never played it again. Although I think they played it this past year.
Yeah, they went back.
As part of the Bob Hope. Well, now they play it, and they shoot 63s because they figured it out. See, that's the interesting thing. The PGA West of the world, just forget the deep bunkers and the rail ties and all that external stuff. You have to think when you play, and that's what those holes at Shinnecock did. They did what Ben Hogan used to say. On the best golf holes, you have to think one shot ahead. And the trouble is, all golfers have played 90% of their rounds of golf on courses that don't require that thought.
Mm-hmm.
So they can often reject a course where you actually have to think a little bit and kind of like tack your way from waypoint to waypoint. You know, in the winter I play a lot of golf, and I'll say, look at how this hole is set up. You should set up on the right side of the tee. You always hit fade. That'll allow you to end up in the fairway. It would be better if you were on the left hand. And I've had my friends turn to me and say, well, I don't want to think when I play. And I say, yeah, but wait a minute. It's 5 seconds a shot.
Mm-hmm.
You shoot 100. It's 500 seconds. You need to think for 8 minutes. You can do that. I know you can.
Yeah. It requires a few, like, brief seconds of intense thought every couple of minutes.
And people reject that, and you see it in the poor average players who are hitting hook every single shot, hitting fade every single shot, and they tee it up in the middle of the tee, and they aim right down the middle.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, if they gave it a little more thought, you know, that kind of course management, when I sometimes think, when someone takes a lesson, you know, they should do a half an hour on what are you having a problem with? Well, your grip. Let's work on your grip, and we'll try to improve that. And then the next half hour, they should sit down and say, look at the golf hole on the computer screen. Where do you want to try to hit it? And, you know, they'll say, well, I'm not sure I want to hit it down the middle. And then the pro would say, well, yeah, but look at how that green, it's kind of what we call a fade green. It moves to the right from front to back. If you play a fade, you can fail positively. If it doesn't fade, you'll have a longer putt. But if it does fade, you're closer to the pin. And by playing fade, because it's a fade green, you'll take those nasty bunkers that play a role in making it a fade green. You'll take them completely out of play. So if folks could read holes a little bit better. But again, I'm not giving them a hard time, because the majority around in their life, they haven't had a hole that was set up so it could be read and played strategically.
And also the education. It's hard to learn about that stuff. I think it almost takes an awakening, and you hit on it a little bit about not having a hole, but I see so many of my friends, they when they finally play a great golf course that has the width and the angles and the strategy, they finally realize that, wait, golf can be different, and there is, like, this better golf that exists.
And when we make a change on an existing course, I generally find that a good percentage of the players find out something's going on by mistake. They hit it down the left side by mistake. They pull it, and when they get there, they see the green is completely open to their next shot, and they start to connect the dots. and then they start to look for that more on the next hole and the next hole after that and the next hole after that. And the way that it manifests itself sometimes is they'll say, "Oh, that was fun." And I'll say, "What do you mean by fun?" I said, "Do you mean easy?" And they said, "Well, no, how could it be easy? You knucklehead, you put 130 bunkers out here. It's not easy, but if we look at it, we see the route we should go." And a lot of times it happens when I play golf with them. I don't hit it very long, but I don't miss many fairways. And I can go down one side or the other, and they say, "Oh, God, you can't hit it out of your shadow, but I see how you look at the holes and how you play them. I'm going to try that." So, unfortunately, I think most times people might get to a Shinnecock, and it goes right over their heads because they're looking at the hay. Mm-hmm. and the distant views and stuff like that, but there's stuff out there. And then, you know, the other thing, Andy, and you know this, many of the courses in the top 100 don't have a shot value in them.
Mm-hmm.
They're just in the top 100.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the top 100 rankings are flawed in the sense that it's not really about the golf course. It's more about the experience, the aesthetics, and it's the window dressing, really. It's the ambiance, the experience, the conditioning.
It's all that stuff, and really, the contest should not be called Best New Golf Courses. That is the wrong name. They should be called the golf course that was lucky enough to be sighted on the most ridiculously foolish natural golf terrain ever conceived by the Lord above.
Or that had enough money to make that.
Yeah. It's interesting. You know, they're the only contest that compare a Yugo against a Ferrari.
Yeah. It's so...
But I couldn't have said it better. You said it. It's all the externals. Oh, God, they came out with cold towels for us
mm-hmm.
to wipe our face and put on our neck at the turn. And I mean, look at most of the evaluation sheets the Raiders fill out. I think on one, shot values is 20%.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what the hell? What else is there?
Well, that's like, there's no playability. There's no... I wrote a whole article about why, you know, people shouldn't even pay attention to Golf Digest top 100 lists. And it just, you know, the rankings would be fine if it was called the top 100 golf experiences, but they
right.
call it the 100 greatest golf courses.
Right.
And it's misconstrued. I played a lot of courses that are ranked above other courses that I know are a lot better. But then when you read the criteria and you start to look and understand the criteria, you understand why certain courses are ranked in certain spots.
Yeah.
And it's because, yeah. oh, they have a giant maintenance budget, or they have, you
or
know,
this
comfort
happened
stations.
In history there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of thing. I had a chance once to speak to a group of Raiders, so I gave my history of golf course design, and two funny things happened afterwards. One was a guy got up and said, "You kept using this," was a Raider, "You kept using this term, and I've never heard it before. What's a Redan?" And then the coordinator of the panelists said to me afterwards, he said, "Wow, that was awesome. You should write a book." And I have to give the panel, some of the guys credit and gals, because afterwards at the cocktail hour, they said, "Could you give us a copy of your PowerPoint?" And I said, "You know, I really as much as I wanted them to know something about design so that they, for what they did, it was just fascinating that those were the comments. And so the next day, I attended a seminar where they had various raters get up and say, well, how do you actually do your ratings? And this guy got up and said, I'm a 3 handicap. And when I rate a course, I bring my son. He's a plus 2. And he brings his wife. She's an 8. So that way we get 3 distinctly different calibers of golfers evaluating the course.
Kind of the same bucket.
You can't make that stuff up.
Yeah. It's
pretty awesome.
So I'd love to talk a little bit about more about Rainer and McDonald. I'm a huge Rainer fan, and we've got a lot of Rainer fans that listen, and would love to hear a little bit about what your favorite template hole is of all the template holes.
Andy, I don't think I can
pick one.
This hole on this specific course?
No, just in general of, like, you know, overarching strategic, you know, strategic hole, like template hole, like from a strategy standpoint, or just the way it sets up, the way it makes you think is your favorite.
Wow, that's really, really hard. You know, I would say the Redan at the National, but I just go out of my mind about the Alps at the National.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really hard pressed. I think what I really love, Andy, is I love to see the different versions of the templates. And I think this is really important, and this is something that's often missed, is that the template holes are not, like, every Redan is not exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe more obvious to some people, every Bieritz is not the same. You know, every Bieritz is not the full 3-level Bieritz. But I think what they did so great was they had their template holes, and they adapted and adopted them to various pieces of land. Their goal was not to make each version of the template exactly the same as every other version. For example, if you play the 17th hole at Pontevedra at the Players Club,
mm-hmm.
it's got a certain look to it, so on and so forth. Well, then you play the 17th hole at PGA West, it's got almost the exact same look to it,
mm-hmm.
where each Redan is different, each punch bowl is different. You know, when I'm driving up the driveway, I wonder if they have a punch bowl, and I wonder if it's a natural punch bowl where the land was like that, like many of them are, or is it more a contrived or constructed punch bowl, which some of them are. So I think I'm not really answering your question.
No.
What my favorite thing about the templates is to see how they are different from course to course. I think that is really, really fascinating. Look, a great one is Alps.
Mm-hmm.
Look at Alps at the National. There's that huge bunker where you bite off as much as you dare, and then your second shot is blind up to the top of that hill. Well, that bears no relationship other than strategically, which is, of course, mildly important to nuts like you and me, to the Alps at Shore Acres.
Mm-hmm.
Or Fox Chapel, where there is that bite-off bunker on one side or the other, but at both of those courses, there are mounds, where if you bite off a lot of the bunker, you have a view of the green. If you bail out, there are mounds in the front and side of the green that block the view of the green. So there are two completely different versions of the template.
Yeah.
And
It's like
each one of them is very cool.
it's like Fishers. If you hit it, if you take on the water down the right side, you get a small sliver of a view of the green.
Yeah, it's very, very cool. So I think that's one thing. And you know, it as you said, it's a real externals thing. When somebody writes an article, and God bless them, the ninth at Yale was always pictured as one of the templates,
Yeah.
or some other really, really famous and maybe more outlandish version of a template is what is pictured. But again, there are Alps. I remember one time we were talking about an Alps, and the guy said, "You explain to me what the Alps is." And he said to me afterwards, a friend of mine, "You have no idea what an Alps is." And I says, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, what you describe bears no relationship to the Alps at the National." And I said, "Well, forgive me, but the Alps at the National has no match in other Alps by Rainer and MacDonald." I said, "I think what you're missing is the lay of the land can be, it's not the lay of the land that really made it. It was how they set it up strategically." So for me, I think that is the coolest thing about Rainer and MacDonald is the presentation of each template is different from course to course. And that's what makes it so much fun when you're driving up the driveway. You're saying, "I wonder if it's going to be like the National, where I can actually kick a low shot off that right front corner of the Redan and have it go kind of diagonally to that tucked left pin." Well, not all of them work that great in that regard. The Redan at Fishers doesn't work quite like that. The Redan at Yeamans Hall it isn't quite like that. But that's what makes them interesting, because it's just not one golf course repeated 75 times. Each one has its own interest. I think that is the nature of their brilliance. And the other thing was, it doesn't appear that what they were doing struck them as outlandish. They just thought they were building a good golf course. Whereas today, if I do a lot of punch bowl greens, people say, "Well, what the hell is that?" Or a Redan, I couldn't hold my ball on the green. Why does it pitch away from the shot?" See, today it appears outlandish. They just were going about their business building cool golf courses that were, you know, that were based on, when you go back and you read, you know, I'm just thrilled if people are able to recognize a template, if they would ever go back and read Scotland's Gift and see how MacDonald came up to selecting the templates. It's just, it couldn't be more fascinating.
You know, one of my favorite things about the template holes is exactly what you said. Is like I remember this winter I played Mountain Lake, and driving in, you see the burettes, and you're like, oh wow. And you, I think that's one of the things why people love watching the Masters year in, year out, is that they know what's coming,
It's familiar to them, no doubt.
And an understanding of templates and a love, like, you know, when you play a Rainer course, you're waiting to see what's around the next corner, and you know, you see these different versions of it, like Mountain Lake's road hole is completely different than, say, Shore Acres road hole or National's road hole, and it is unique, and I think that's where it's so misunderstood, is people think that it's just, you know, a replica course, but it's not a replica course in any way.
No, that's a real good connection, Andy. That's what they think it is. And it's unquestioned, it isn't that. But you know, on the other hand, you could go to a contemporary course where an architect copies a hole and it's exactly like the other version. It hasn't been an adaptation of it. And I, you know, I read an article once where one of the more famous contemporary architects said, well, why would I want to repeat themes on a golf hole when there are so many new themes still to be designed or or practiced? And, you know, it was just such a ludicrous thing to say, especially if you investigated the body of work that, you know, he's talking about.
Yeah.
But it's hard to charge $2 million. It's hard to charge $1 million or $2 million on a course when you tell the client, I'm going to base this on the work of Rayner and McDonald.
So we got a lot of questions from readers and followers. I put out that you were coming on, and so I wanted to get to a few of those if
sure.
you don't mind. So here's a question. So everyone seems to, and this is from Michael Wolf, everyone seems to now agree getting back to the GCA principles of 1900 to 1930s is best for golf, and restorations are where the work is now. He wants to know, what about the hundreds of golf courses, hundreds and thousands of golf courses built in the 80s and 90s, and what do you do with all of them? Like, can these residential courses that were built with narrow fairways be retrofitted in any way, or?
I think they can. And Andy, you know, we all have to be, those of us who are betrothed to the 1900s to 1930s, we have to admit, not everyone that was built then was great. You know, there were a lot of 18 stakes on a Sunday afternoon that were not tremendous golf courses. You know, we think of a place like Seminole that, to me, has the greatest alternating shot shapes of any Ross course I've ever seen. Spectacularly well done. I think the greatest angles of any Ross course I've ever seen. But, you know, Donald and AW and all the rest of the gang, they didn't do all the courses built. But I think you can still do a good job even without a 300-foot wide corridor. You can still, let me say, I've worked on those courses. I haven't seen one where you can't get some twist and turn in the fairways, where you can't get the fairway bunkers to more significantly impact the twist and turn, where you can't think about angles on the greens. In all honesty, I think the narrowness of the corridors, I don't like it, but I think it's a little bit too comfortable an excuse to use for why a course couldn't be made more interesting to play and more fun to play.
So how would you go about, you know, kind of working with narrow corridors now that you're kind of awakening? Say somebody said, hey, we want to bring you back to one of your courses in the early days where you built with narrow fairways.
Well, I would still, if I went back to one of my courses where my fairways are 30 yards wide, I would still put bunkers in. That there's always room in the original tree planting to let a bunker stick into the fairway, say on the hook side, and let it swing out more and narrow the amount of rough until you get to the trees, so you get that sinewy type fairway.
I guess
that's one of the first things I think about. I was just doing it the other day on Google Earth, where someone had called me and I looked at their golf course, and I was already trying to think of how I could get more movement. Now, Andy, I don't mean movement like contour mowing, where the fairway is 35 yards wide for the shortest hitter, 20 yards wide for the guy who hits a 220, and then 10 yards wide, that thing from the 80s and the early 90s. I mean a fairway consistent with the fairway that just twists and turns on its way to the green. So I think you can do it in narrow corridors and narrow fairways. And because usually when I did narrow fairways, I had a good amount of rough, and I would see some of that rough being converted to fairway.
Yeah, widening out. I think that's a good strategy is getting turning a lot of the rough into fairway and getting a little bit
We just,
wider.
I said that I would not mention names of golf courses that I work on because it's kind of the club's business, and I know that's what everybody likes to do. When I worked at so and so, and I worked in such and such, but we worked at a 1960s designed golf course on Long Island last year, and I would say one of the main things we did was turn the angle of the bunkers and make the fairways bigger. And there was room to do the twist and turn. And I would say that they range between pleasantly surprised to completely stunned how they have to think on their golf course now. It was just the typical 60s golf course, dead straight fairway edges and bunkers that were parallel to the center line and never impacted play. So, I think you can do it even in narrow corridors. Obviously, you can't do it as well, but you can still get that feel of the flow.
Yeah, that it makes sense. It's so David Grady wants to know how kind of renovation and restoration has evolved over the past 20 years.
Well, for me, I, it's hard for me to speak for everyone. I've never been the mouthpiece for the craft, but I would say at the very least, there appears to be more appreciation for, as a first step, trying to determine what that golf course was like originally. And then seeing what of that you could emphasize in your work, and what to me, if this is an older course, what vintage characteristics you could put into the course and put them in a manner that people think that they were always there if they weren't there originally. So, I think there's a little bit more appreciation for what might have been there originally. Today, I think there's a little bit more appreciation for what was there originally and what may have been taken out. But, you still hear about this course or that course, fill in the blank here, designed by a Golden Age architect that the club is not entirely appreciative of that. And who they hire is not totally appreciative of that, and they get a course in the fill in the architect's name mode. So I think folks like you and me, Andy, who like that stuff, think that it's everywhere, and it's far from everywhere yet.
So what's a course that you'd like to see host a major championship that hasn't or isn't hosting major championships?
Oh boy, I Andy, I don't know off the top of my head.
That's okay.
I'm trying to kind of factor in I'm kind of trying to factor in the way they set up these major championships. I find it interesting that the major golf associations pick some of these out of the box sites that kind of don't fit into the Wingfoot, Oakmont, Southern Hills, Pebble Beach. You know what I mean? The typical rota, and they pick them 5 years before they play them, and then they spend $3 or $5 million getting the course ready for the event. There's a degree of standardization that I get discomforted by. I'm not doing very good naming courses that I think should be major sites.
It's okay. It's a question I always think about. It's like, but one of the big problems is the ball. It goes just too far for a lot of these courses, and then you also combine the infrastructure needed.
You know, it's really the great shame of the game that it's broken into two armed camps. There's a camp that loves the game of golf, and unfortunately, that's the small camp now. And there's a camp that loves the business of golf. And the camp in the business of golf has so directly or indirectly intimidated the ruling bodies of golf that they won't take the step that is absolutely essential, and that is to slow down the ball. It's really a shame. It's the game's unfinest moment that this continues.
I was out at Skokie yesterday. I was walking with a guy, and he was like, "Man, how great would it be to see a major championship at this place?" And it's like, it would be great. The greens are unbelievable, but you can't because the ball just goes too far.
I think that's part of my inability to answer the question. There are dozens and dozens of courses like Skokie that I would love to see. That if we could just turn the clock back to the late '60s, and the players had to hit into a green what Nicklaus and players like that were hitting into a green, that would be my dream to see that happen. But you know, that will never happen, and so that makes it hard for me to answer which one would you like to see a major event at, because I'd like to see a major event at hundreds of them, but not with today's equipment.
Yeah, I
I
agree.
believe that working the ball is part of the game, and I'm going to go to my grave thinking it should be part of the game. And like on the tour now, it's not. It's just power golf. But I think a guy standing up on a tee, reading the hole and saying, I want to cut this one, or standing up on the tee and I want to turn this the other way, and here's an angle of a green, I can fail positively by hitting a fade, because if I fail to hit a fade and hit it straight, I'm putting. It's a longer putt, but if I am successful hitting a fade, I'm putting for birdie. So the equipment thing is just overwhelming. I mean, I have clients say to me, why are you worried about the angles and this stuff? These young kids and our good players, they never even think about that. And I say, well, I think we still should think about it, and we should try to make it a part of their game as much as it's a part of players who don't hit it as far. And I think the restoration thing is maybe refining itself a little to either moving some bunkers down a fairway so that the original intent of the design is recaptured, or maybe adding a few more bunkers in the correct style so the original intent, the intent of the original design is captured. Because just if you think of it, Andy, just taking a plan or having an old aerial and putting the bunkers back, the fairway bunkers back exactly where they are.
Isn't, yeah,
I've
it.
had people I've had people say to me, are you really restoring the intent of the original design? And I have to admit, they make a good point.
Yeah, it's, I agree with that because like the
And so
intent's been lost with a lot of the technology, so you'd need to move bunkers into different
yeah.
places in order to regain that intent.
And see, that's why I think that one of the more important rules about design is you sit down and breathe deeply and think a little bit about it. Sometimes it's right to put original bunkers back exactly where they were, but to just stick on that goal probably doesn't restore the original intent of play.
Yeah.
Just like going to an old course and saying, ah, this place is old, I'm just going to do the modern thing here. That probably is too quick of a knee-jerk reaction. You know, just like the players who need to think for that 5 seconds we determined standing on a tee, the guys with the pencils in their hands need to think for a few minutes, where does some of the original stuff work in terms of bunker placement? And look, if I could do a course a third, an eighth, a tenth as good as any of the golden ages, I'd be very proud of myself. But I don't think it's wrong to say that original set of bunkers just doesn't work for the modern game. Mm-hmm. Is there a and then the job becomes, how can I find a natural spot? Because a lot of times they were placing their bunkers in nice natural spots for bunkers where there were upslopes where they could just cut a hole in the ground and it became a good bunker. It didn't look artificial. It looked like it set into the landscape. Is there a spot where I can recreate that same feel by putting it into an upslope where the grade works, or can I build an upslope that when it's grassed, people will think it was always there?
Yeah, nothing looks better than natural bunkers, and so we do this.
My test for my guy on the bulldozer is I just say to him, and they laugh. Now they're used to it, but I say, "Is that a comfortable bunker?" and I say, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, does that?" And you know, you go to these courses where bunkers have been added further down holes, or you go to courses built in the 60s, what I call the age of golf course engineering rather than golf course architecture, but it continues today. There are people who still follow that inspiration of the 60s. They may disguise it by ripping the edges of their bunkers, but they're still basically 60s golf courses. You know, fade bunkers are all the exact same distance from the tee. Hook bunkers are all the exact same distance from the tee. And you'll see some of these bunkers where they're built on a reverse slope, but that reverse slope just happened to be the right distance from the tee. And, you know, there's a berm that's 12 feet high behind the bunker holding it up. Hopefully, if you're working in a restorative manner, you can get a comfortable bunker, or I'll say to the guys, does that bunker look like it's supposed to be there? I think that's the other thing. It's not only putting the bunker in the same spot that the golden ager had it on the plan, or putting it in a spot that has the same impact on the hole as what the golden ager was thinking. It's can you detail it so it looks like it's been there for a long time and wasn't built 3 weeks ago last Tuesday?
Yeah, it's naturalness. So we have this segment that we wrap up these podcasts with called Overrated, Underrated. And we'll give you a couple topics and you just say if you think they're overrated or underrated, and you can give like a quick, short kind of explanation as to your answer.
Andy, you haven't been listening if you think I can give a quick and short explanation, but I'm going to try my best.
Yeah. So Herbert Strong, the architect.
Oh, I'll be honest with you. I'm going to go in between overrated and underrated.
You're going properly?
Yeah, I would just say he's an in-between. You know, that's what I think.
Okay. Grass bunkers.
I think they're a little overrated. I have clubs that want to convert sand bunkers into grass bunkers, and in most of the situations where they want to do that, it's not an even trade visually, mm-hmm, or strategically, or helping players recognize the angles and so forth. You know, there's been a lot of, it's just one more paragraph. There's a lot of talk about bunkers today, maintenance costs and all that kind of stuff, but they're a part of golf. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that everyone can be replaced by either a tree or a grass bunker.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I do like grass bunkers. I think that they're really tough for the good player, and they're a little bit more playable than regular bunkers for the average and beginner.
Yeah, I think it's just it their positioning, and maybe they're part of a bunker group or something like that is kind of an important thing to consider.
So how about the blind tee shot?
It's dramatically underrated. Makes me insane how the degree to which they're rejected and considered a bad thing. And I would say the same thing for the blind shot to a green. It makes me crazy that they are so rejected and disliked. It's a shot in golf. I got to tell you, Andy, when I read a review of a course that starts out with, "This is a great course, everything is right out in front of you," I rarely finish the review, and I never have any interest in seeing that course.
You like to have a little bit of the thrill, and there's that feel of a blind shot or rolling up to like a punch bowl green that's blind on an Alps hole and wondering where your ball is that can't be replaced.
No, tell me that when you're walking and you hit a shot to a blind green that's a punch bowl, you don't throw the iron back in the bag and then double time it up the hill.
Yeah, you're
Or
well.
if
Much
you're
faster.
forced to, you get in the cart and you don't floor it to get around the corner. 2 or 3 years ago, or 4 years ago, I went to Southern Scotland and I played a course called Nairn that has about 20 blind shots. It is one of my five favorite golf courses in the world. It was unbelievably great. And I would think that most people would say, and it's only because I love blind shots, that's not a good thing. You know, you got to love it. If it's a blind shot to a green, more often than not, there's some degree of punch bowl character to one side or all of the green. And so a hack like me, I can miss the green and it ends up 12 feet from the pin. That's one thing that we've forgotten. Golf is supposed to be fun. And I think blind shots are wicked fun.
It's I like blind shots. I'm a fan.
And I can't believe the percentage of better drives I hit on a blind shot because I have to concentrate. You're making yourself concentrate so much more on somehow picking a line. And I would say, more often than not, I hit one of my better drives of the day because it's made me focus. There's nothing wrong with something that makes you hit one of your better drives of the day.
Yeah, I agree. What about ocean and water views?
I think they could not be more spectacularly overrated.
I agree. I think they take away from the architecture. They're awesome when combined with great architecture, but they make average holes very perceived great.
Right before I take my last breath, somebody's going to hand me a piece of paper, and it's a rating of Pebble Beach that got, after the course got moved 50 miles inland.
It wouldn't be as good, huh?
Well, I would think it might be different. But I feel that way about courses set at the base of mountains, set in sand dunes and stuff like that. And I know they can't do it. I know they can't. I know it's too hard to do. And I'm not even being a wise guy. But if the raters just looked at the tops of the tees, the tops of the fairways, the tops of the greens, and the angles and the variety that they introduced into the round of golf, I'd like to see the ratings in those circumstances.
I'm curious. I played Fisher's Island and Chicago Golf in a week span for the first time on each of them. How would you compare the two of those?
I don't like to directly compare.
Yeah.
And if
How, Well, let's say this.
If you told me you were gonna, if you told me that you were
how would you
wanted
split
to play
10?
Golf at me at my selection out of those two, I would tell you to pick me up at O'Hare.
Yeah, that's I feel the same. So I think like I always look at these courses, and if I have to compare, is like dividing 10 rounds, how would I would divide 10 rounds. And I've thought about that one more than almost anyone. And I think I'd go 6-4 or 7-3 Chicago Golf.
I would just say, pick me up at O'Hare, Andy.
That place is one of the most architecturally sound golf courses I've ever seen. Probably ever. It probably is the most.
And when nuts like you and I say things like that, we should say, and it's on a nondescript site.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Yeah, I think the site that it's on is underrated. I think people say it's a bad site, but it's a pretty good site.
But, you know, relative to these other World Fair sites, Andy.
Yeah. Relative to Fisher's
Ocean,
Island, that has water views on every hole, yes.
Yes, so. Yeah. So, and that's another thing that I find interesting is someone will go to a course, well, it's not much of a course. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, the site, it's just flat. I think St. Andrews is a fairly strategic golf course.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing really special about that site. I think the site is too often an easy excuse. On flat land, I honestly can't figure out why Florida doesn't have 500 great golf courses.
I think the thing I notice is you can really tell the skill of an architect with what they do with flat land. Like
no doubt. I won't try to say it better. You just said it great. And I think too often things like, well, the developer wanted this. Well, the developer wanted a hard penal golf course. Well, the land was flat. I just think sometimes they're excuses that are too convenient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because on a flat piece of land, these holes I'm talking about are Shinnecock. They're on a flat piece of land,
mm-hmm.
And they're great golf courses because they have the angles and the strategy. And in Florida, you could do any degree of angles, any amount of sinewy fairway. The green angles could be anything. And basically, what do you see? There's a fade bunker at a certain distance. There's a hook bunker at a certain distance. And then at the green, there's a green or a bunker at 3 o'clock, 9 o'clock, and 12 o'clock.
Well,
they're golf course engineering and not golf course design.
It goes to your whole adage of when it was developed. It was developed; those courses were developed from 1950, primarily 1950 through 1995.
Yeah, it was the age of golf course engineering.
Yep, not architecture. So
no, you could never. You could never say that. It was. Let's slap it in quick and get to the next victim.
Yep. So, Brian, I really appreciate the time, and that was a lot of fun. We'll have to do it again sometime. I feel like we only touched on about 10% of the topics I wanted to get to.
Yeah, my answers that go on and on forever will limit the amount of questions. So I'll just tell you one thing. I'll be looking at that phone call telling me when I should get to O'Hare to play the course I chose over the one that's on the island.
I'll be trying to figure out when I can get out there again.
All right, big guy. Hey, good talking to you. Thank you.